From True Africa, I'm Claude Winitsky, and this is Limitless.
These female stories that were previously considered unimportant in a male-dominated field, we're talking about the era of Chinua Achebe and Wole, all these greats, and suddenly the understanding that women can actually bring unforeseen, subvertive perspectives.
Welcome to Limitless, the podcast that asks the questions that matter for Africa. We're looking for African solutions to African problems. The Limitless podcast is supported by the U.S. Department of State and the Ceasefire Foundation. Novuyo Rosa Chuma is an award-winning Zimbabwean novelist who teaches at the acclaimed Iowa Writers Workshop in the U.S., like many literary icons before her. And she's only 36 years old. Her debut novel, House of Stone, is set during the Gukahurundi massacres that took place immediately after Zimbabwean independence and remained shrouded in secrecy. Her second novel, Digging Stars, also received glowing reviews. It deals with an equally uncomfortable history. She charts the similarities between the reserves allocated to Native Americans in the U.S. and those allocated to indigenous people in South Africa and Zimbabwe. This is a must listen for anyone interested in African fiction, interested in reading it, of course, but also interested in how it is produced. Novuyo gives us a peek behind the scenes of some of the US's most prestigious writing institutions, and she tells us what it's like to be a young African woman professor there. She's equally clear-sighted about the situation in Zimbabwe and what it's like to come back home with your partner when you are queer. It's a wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Novuyo Rosa Chuma, welcome to Limitless Africa.
Thank you, Claude. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be talking to you today.
Well, the pleasure and the honor is mine. Your novels are critically acclaimed. Glowing reviews in the New York Times, The Guardian in the UK, all kinds of publications praising you. So let's start with you and who you are. So tell us about yourself.
Thank you, Claude. Well, first and foremost, I'm a reader. I've always been curious. I've always loved books ever since I was a child. And it's something I learned from my father. You know, he gave me a love for reading, and from there bloomed a love for writing. So the two are intertwined. I'm always reading across genres, across disciplines. And so that's what fuels my writing and my curiosity and hunger about the world. I'm also an immigrant. I've lived in the USA for the past 10 years. Before that, I was in South Africa for 4 years. And I'm originally from Zimbabwe, where I spent the first 20 years of my life. I'm also an academic and an educator. I teach creative writing at Emerson College in Boston. I'm also faculty director of the James Baldwin Summer Program. It's a program that Emerson runs each year, and it takes place in Paris. And that's another opportunity to take our students, mostly from underrepresented backgrounds, abroad to learn about James Baldwin's life and his work in fiction and nonfiction, and how it might inspire them to think broadly and engage with the world in their work.
One thing I wanted to ask you about in your illustrious background is your experience in the MFA in creative writing from the Iowa Writers Workshop. It's very prestigious. I've heard so many tales about that program where literally the day you arrive, you have different agents and publishers lining up to sign you up as an author. Tell us about that experience, because it must have been a formative one.
Oh, Claude, it was very formative. I got the call about being admitted into Iowa. I was in Cape Town. And I cannot explain, at the time in 2012, was early 2013, the MFA hadn't really exploded globally, I would say. I really didn't know much about MFA programs. I'd been in touch with the writer No Violet Wulawayo, who'd inspired me to apply for these programs. So I really did not know what Iowa was, except they were giving me a full scholarship to go there.
And we like that. Full scholarship. We like that. It sounds very much like free.
I mean, it was really incredible when I got there. I think I loved being in this space surrounded by people who loved to write, who loved books. It was just an everyday staple. Over coffee, over drinks with friends, we were always talking about writing and books. I also appreciated the global nature of the program. Some great friends there from India, from Jamaica, and also a lot of Black American writers and writers of color. And this speaks to the current director, Lan Samantha Chang, who's Chinese American's efforts to diversify the program. And yes, agents do visit the program. I met my agent there. And so that's part of the, I guess, the prestige of the program, because it's known for its writing.
And you've actually gone back there to teach fiction, right? Tell us about going back.
It was really an honor for me to have the workshop invite me to come and teach. I think it spoke to my growth as a writer, and the work I'd done there and the work I could do there, mentoring students. And it's one of my most profound experiences as a teacher. The students there are very energetic, outspoken, and gregarious. So it was also interesting to sit on the other side and sort of understand how the classroom works from a professor's standpoint.
Yeah, in terms of sitting on the other side, you describe yourself as a reader, but also you're a writer and you're also a professor. Why did you feel that it was important to become a professor and to get your PhD in literature and creative writing from the University of Houston?
Oh, yeah, the University of Houston. That's another great program in the USA. It's one of the top PhD creative writing programs in the USA. Now, I wanted to expand my intellectual horizons, Claude. I think it also comes from just, again, my father as an inspiration. My father was a lawyer, but he was also a doctor, Dr. Chuma, doctor of philosophy, someone who loved knowledge and education and really wanted to reach as high as I could go. I think it's also a very African thing.
I was going to say that. We Africans, we can never get enough education, right?
I would say Zimbabweans and Nigerians are famed for just having PhDs. But that really opened my doors to the importance of teaching, right? And not just teaching fiction, the craft of fiction, but art is also a way to think together, to build empathy, diversity, right? I think the humanities are really good at that, at cultivating stewardship, citizenship, and that's really what I'm interested in the classroom.
Right, in the classroom and in life as well. I want to talk a little bit about life and being an author, being a novelist, and specifically your first novel, House of Stone. And in that book, you kind of dug into the history of the Gukurahundi. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and perhaps help us to understand that history for those of us and those of us listeners who don't actually know that history?
Oh, House of Stone. Oh, Claude.
All the way back. Let's take it back there.
I started writing House of Stone, thinking about House of Stone. I was 23. I was really young, but I was so hungry for my history. You know, I was in South Africa, I was a student there, and feeling unwelcome. You know, I'd say I learned how to become Zimbabwean in South Africa, because there was this constant fascination with Zimbabwe as this crumbling nation. And we became really flattened as a people. And I really began to wonder, how did we come to be? Why is Zimbabwe the way it is? And as I read up on the history, I realized I do not know my country's history. And there's a certain pleasure to see yourself, to see your past, to understand yourself. Now, Gukurahundi became the focal point of the novel, because when I asked my mother about it, you know, I'd ask about the Civil War, and she'd speak lightly about it. We don't really talk about history in Zimbabwe, even among families. When I mentioned Gukurahundi, I remember she froze, and I thought there's a wound there, there's something there. And growing up, we were never really encouraged or allowed to talk about Gukurahundi. So these are massacres that took place in Matabele land and Midlands part of the country, right after independence in the mid-1980s. They were state-sponsored massacres, state-sponsored genocide. But because we don't really know much about that time, the documents, the government documents about that time are sealed. It has been manipulated or cast as a Shona versus Ndebele, as an ethnic conflict. And that's been one of the most damaging aspects of it. When I, growing up, I learned that's what Kukurahundi was about. And in reading the archives and understand the role of politics, I saw it as Zimbabwe's first sin. Right? This was the, when Mugabe, our ex-president and one of the oldest presidents in Africa and world history, started persecuting political dissidents, those who had different views, right? The understanding is that because Matabele Land and Midlands had not voted for the ruling ZANU-PF party in the 1980 elections, they were being punished for that. The massacres are horrible when you read the transcripts. They speak of torture, starvation, families being forced to kill their family members, bury them, dance on their graves. It's really atrocious. What's really horrible is that there's been no reckoning with that. So the victims have gone unacknowledged. They did not receive any help, any social. And I'm thinking of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa as a comparison. So we have a lot of wounds. And so that's really what I wanted to sit with and make sense of and try and understand.
Well, it's interesting that this history was taking place immediately after the late President Mugabe that you just mentioned was being hailed as one of the freedom fighters of Africa. I mean, Bob Marley released that album Zimbabwe that we remember, right, as a tribute to that fight that was led by Mugabe and others. And I often think about how so many of us Africans just don't know very much about our own history, even the recent history, the post-independence history. Why did you decide to focus on that specific history as it pertains to your country?
I think it has to do with the fact that it felt like something that's repressed, a wound that's repressed, and for me, that links to all other wounds. For me, the tactics that were used in Kukurahundi, if you read up on it, some of them were used during our war for independence. And some of those tactics were later used in the 2000s when ZANU-PF was repressing its citizens. Operation Murambatwina, Operation Clean Out the Rubbish, where opposition party supporters in the 2000s had their homes bulldozed, right? That's a mechanism that was also used in 1980. So for me, it felt like a central sort of wound for me that could help us understand other wounds. And you know, in Africa, you know, it's the thing is, history is not easy to talk about. It's so traumatic. I remember during my writing of House of Stone, I went for therapy and I started talking. I took the book for therapy. I needed to also make sense and work through what excavating this issue was doing to me, to my psyche, to my body, to my emotions. So I think we also underestimate just how difficult it is talk about this history and work through it. And
yeah, that's what.
We need state structures. We need state support. It cannot just be people looking through history. We need help as to how to look at that history and how to heal from that history.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. I was going to interrupt you to ask you specifically about history. One thing that I read in the Guardian review, which again was a rave review, was that you went back into the history of your country and taking it all the way back to the arrival of Cecil Rhodes and then kind of going into the history of the Ndebele royals and so on. How were you able to do this sort of research when there's not that much archival material that's really available in print?
So this is, you know, so interesting. This is where South Africa, the University of Witwatersrand Library, and the University of Iowa libraries and the U.S. libraries became so invaluable. I cannot tell you how many books I was shocked or delighted to discover in those archives that are not available in Zimbabwe. We have, you know, some lovely material. We have historians like Terence Ranger. We have novels from the period. For Kukurahundi, there's a book by Eleanor Sisulu, which is based on the Catholic Commission reports on the massacres. This happened about a decade after the massacres in the 1990s. They were looking back to try and find out what happened and to seek reprieve for the victims. So, of course, that never happened. So there was that aspect. But then there was also talking to family, talking to people. My family was, this oral history was a great repository of knowledge. At one point, I wanted to go and see the graves in Balagwe, in Zimbabwe, This was during a trip home, and I was warned not to go there, so I did not go there.
Why did people warn you not to go there?
Well, you're told, you know, you'll disappear, like you're caught in trouble. You can't go to the village and start asking these sorts of questions without caught in trouble, right?
Right.
Many activists in Zimbabwe have, you know, disappeared or paid the price. But for me, the structure of House of Stone actually mirrors exactly what you're talking about, the difficulty of excavating history. If you see Zamani, the main character, who's obsessed with history, he's becomes even very sociopathic in his quest for history. You see the difficulty of just finding that history, whether from talking to people and trying to get them to relive very painful moments, or the archives, which really don't provide much access. This, for me, is why fiction became a very important way to talk about that history. Because there's also the fictive imagination to imagine oneself into various moments as a way to get to a closer sort of human truth about what that experience was like for the people who lived through it.
I want to maybe segue a little bit and talk about your other novel, which is Digging Stars. And that book is really about the global nature of colonization and, you know, certain histories that again, you were able to uncover. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yes. That seems that's a running theme in my novels, connections between histories and peoples. Digging Stars started off as sort of an attempt to understand America. But my main character, Tandwe, is Zimbabwean. And so that became really key to me, sort of understand who is speaking, right? Who's this person who's speaking about America? And at first it was an immigrant novel, right? And the immigrant novel is a trope. Until I came across this history about the connections between the North American reservation and our tribal homelands, what we call Ama Reserva in Zimbabwe. This actually came from a book from Mahmoud Mamdani called Neither Settler Nor Native. And he says he was in South Africa researching apartheid, and he was interested in this connection between the South African Reserve and the North American reservations. Like, why are the names similar? And then he discovered that in 1910, the apartheid government sent delegates to Canada and the USA to study the North American reservation. They liked what they saw, and they brought back that model to South Africa. And I thought, wait a minute. Growing up, we always hear, Ama Reserva in Zimbabwe, Ama Reserva, how come we have never actually made this connection? Then I went into the archives, and if you see the British Parliament, the UK Parliament proceedings around the 1920s when they're talking about Rhodesia, they were speaking about this model in South Africa, right? That South Africa had brought from the US, and they used that to model the Land Act in Zimbabwe, the Native Land Act, right? And so suddenly that history connected us, right? This idea of taking a piece of land, usually very non-arable, and just squeezing the indigenous people onto that land. Suddenly, for me, American history came alive. And my first question was, how come we do not know this history in Zimbabwe? How come we don't talk about this connection? We don't really learn much about Native Americans in Zimbabwe, or even this as a country, or as a people who are trying to decolonize, who are trying to reclaim our past. This seems very important. So that became my entry into the novel. And so the novel became really about colonization, even in the modern sense. You know, the writer Titi Tangarimba visited Emerson College last year, and she said something interesting. She said Britain was an external colonizer, and she has cast ZANU-PF as an internal colonizer, right? Because this is ideas of the values and morals that we carry in our society, which structurally actually come from the Rhodesian state. If you notice our country structures, including customary law, which is actually not native, but was created by the British administration to manage the indigenous population, little of that has changed in Zimbabwe. And so that for me became that exploration. And so when Atandwa goes to the US, she does something I haven't seen in any other immigrant novel. She interacts with indigenous characters. And that's for me is the push and pull, where these characters are struggling through this history, struggling to understand one another, alienated from one another.
When I was reading the New York Times review that came out in September of 2023, the review said that the story opens with Atandwa, who you just mentioned, and a father, Frank, who are reunited for the first time in New York City. And even though they're from Zimbabwe, you start with New York City. Why choose New York City of all places as the beginning and the opening of the story. I say that because I live in New York City and I consider myself a Togolese New Yorker.
Fascinating. No, so that actually links into one of the themes of the novel, which is astronomy, indigenous science. So indigeneity for me, science, knowledge was also part of this novel. It's key to understand the novel. My characters were grappling with and excited with knowledge, the stars, science, and what it means to practice science in a contemporary sense. So Frank is in New York because he is a professor of astronomy, and he becomes a tangible link to the field of science and astronomy. And in that first part of the novel, we follow his history and we learn about how he grew up in Amar Reserva, in the rural homelands in Zimbabwe, watching the stars, stargazing, right? Before he went to mission school and was gained a scholarship to go to the US, right? And so for me, this is the nature of just the progression of how indigenous knowledge becomes, I guess, co-opted into mainstream knowledge. But it's also just about the exchange of knowledges and human cultures. Frank's experiences change him, and he starts to grapple with what it means to practice science as an indigenous person. He's also a very controversial figure, but you have to read the novel to find that out. So for me, it's also about lineage, right? I'm interested in America as the center of knowledge, because when we think of space, just say space exploration, what comes to mind? America, right? From public sort of films and literature to NASA. You know, I follow the NASA space station on Instagram. There's just always update on what's going on in the stars. When we think of the future, we think of America. America also, because again, for me, it's a global space that also imports its technologies, including settler technology. It was important for me that the novel starts in the center, right, the heart of empire, so that we understand how knowledge gets diffused from empire, also gets absorbed by empire.
Yeah, very interesting how you would talk about empire in this very new way, right? Because when people think of empire as it relates to Zimbabwe or Africa, you know, they really think of the United Kingdom. But in your case, I want to take it back to, yes, right? So, you know, it's interesting because I heard you mention Tsitsi Dangarembga, who is a very prominent Zimbabwe-born author. And, you know, there's Noviolet Bulawayo. There's a few of you rising stars or established stars on the literary scene who are women from Zimbabwe. Why do you think you and your peers, I'll call it, are having so much success at the moment?
I mean, this is a wonderful landmark moment. I remember the writer Tsitsi Dangarembga speaks about how her landmark book Nervous Conditions was disparaged, ignored in the 80s when she first wrote it. I think it took 8 years for her to publish it from the time she wrote it. She really struggled with that book. And I think that was an era where the Zimbabwe's male writers were sort of taking center stage. So I think it's really great that right now the women writers are enjoying this public moment. I think it also just has to do with the ways in which we are telling the stories that we are telling. There's a lot of breadth and depth and nuance, I think, in sort of the woman's perspective, the female perspective. These female stories that were previously considered unimportant in a male-dominated field, right? We're talking about the era of Chinua Achebe and Wole, all these greats. And suddenly, the understanding that women can actually bring unforeseen, subtle, subvertive perspectives, right? Because of their position in society. And, you know, and I really also don't want to essentialize women, because the character in House of Stone, the main character Zamani, is actually a young man, though he was written by me. But I think it just speaks to the creativity. If you read Noviolet Bulawayo's latest book, Glory, it is a romp. It is insane. Just the level of craft and creativity. The talking animals. If you read Tsitsi Dangarembga's This Mournable Body again, you have this Kafkaesque writing that's being mined. You have new up-and-coming brilliant Zimbabwean writers like Yvette Nisandlovu, who's into fantasy and horror. She's working on a fantasy novel on Great Zimbabwe, and I look forward to that. I think women writers, we are not afraid to, I think, experiment, to break the mold.
Yeah, breaking the mold is something that I'm seeing a lot, and I often talk about it with my friend Kuzanai Chirai, who is going to be at the Venice Biennale this year as a visual artist. And here in the United States, we have people like Danai Gururapi. A lot of people don't know that she's actually originally from Zimbabwe, even though she was born in Iowa, that we just mentioned, right? And she's the Black Panther in the Black Panther series. So very interesting, this creative scene, that not just in literature, but also in other creative spheres. So that's, to me, is really fascinating. Do you feel this as well, or is it just me and my journalistic eye?
Oh no, definitely I feel it. I feel it. It's exciting for me to see Zimbabwe have this moment. I love that you mentioned Danai. I think any Zimbabwean who hears that name would already recognize a fellow sister. But it's exciting because I think we have seen what this diversity has done for, you know, a country like Nigeria. For me, I think it's quite remarkable that Zimbabwe, with our 60 million citizens, we're really tiny, able to produce so much art, so much, you know, of beauty, so much creativity. We're quite prolific for our size. And so this also feeds into other creatives, right? You see what others are doing, you gain ideas, you get to see what's possible out there in terms of art and creativity. I really, you know, what's really hard at the moment and what I wish we could do more of is sort of give back. Zimbabwe is a landscape is just very tricky right now. It's in terms of the arts and what's possible. But the idea of what can all these creatives do together, what can we do to cultivate the arts at home is something I'm grappling
with. Right, but you have publications. You there's a lot there that is not necessarily exported, but there's a thriving creative scene in Zimbabwe, right? With publications that are, you know, maybe not so widely distributed, but are still extremely influential.
Yes, but that's the, you know, so that's when you go to like Zimbabwe, like the creators there talk about that, this idea of an industry of distribution. I mean, Weaver Press recently shut down, right? This is one of our, you know, great independent presses that has done so much for the creative arts in Zimbabwe, and they said they simply couldn't sustain
themselves. Didn't even know that. That's so sad. That's almost tragic.
That is so sad. They closed earlier this year. And so, yeah, I'm thinking of, if you think of Nigeria as a scene where they somehow have managed to build a local industry, right? You have Masobe Books, you have these independent publishers in Nigeria who are publishing locally, even books that are published overseas and bringing them. That's what Weaver Press did. So in Zimbabwe, I guess my thing is how could we get people to stay rather than leave? We have the Writers International Network of Zimbabwe, run by Bivinta Putera, which is doing great work, right? But you know, because the world is global, and I think because creators elsewhere see what's happening in the global north, there's then always a question and a hunger about what can be done in the global south to also build and shop those structures. So that creatives are able in some way or other to sustain themselves. It's not even just financial, just in terms of just intellectual or you know, personal creative satisfaction, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. As somebody who's been a key player in this field for quite a few years now, I want to say that what I've learned is the importance of collaboration, cooperation, knowledge transfer, paying it forward between Africans in the diaspora and Africans living on the continent. We mentioned Nigerians. They're very good at that, right? Beautiful. They have these links between Lagos and all kinds of cities in America and also in the UK, which are quite powerful and allow for great expansion of creativity in my field. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Wanted to perhaps ask you a little bit about your own path to the United States. Because when I mentioned Danai Gururapi, I mean, her parents, as many African parents came, they came as academics, right? I think they first settled in Wisconsin before Iowa. What about you? How were you able to come to America?
Oh, so I came on scholarship. So I got into the Iowa.
Oh, so that was the first scholarship that you mentioned earlier. That was your first, okay.
Yes, I'd studied economics in South Africa, and but I wanted to follow writing as a career path, as a vocation, and so I'd applied, and I came here, I guess, through privileged means, you'd say, through school, through academia, and I stayed. So I did my MFA, did my PhD, and then was fortunate enough to get a job as a professor at Emerson College, And so it moves from just coming for school to suddenly you're building a life here, right? Suddenly you're building community here. Suddenly it's been 10 years and you realize that this is where you're now settling. It can be quite shocking to realize that, but yes.
Yeah. So let me then ask you about the community that you first kind of encountered when you moved to Iowa. Was there in the broader United States any sort of Zimbabwe community that you could lean on, or were you not really even interested in that given the diversity that you saw on campus, as you mentioned earlier?
I love that. I mean, there were few Zimbabweans in Iowa, actually.
Few Africans there. In Iowa. Few black people in Africa. Few black people in Iowa, I would even say.
Exactly. I mean, most Africans, anywhere you go here in the US, are mostly from West Africa. So I've actually have more, I guess, relationships with like West African communities, with the Nigerian communities. But I will say Houston has a thriving Zimbabwean community there. That was really wonderful for me. We had celebrations, Independence Day celebrations, regular get-togethers as a Zimbabwean network. And in Boston, I moved to Boston during COVID. So my first time encountering other Zimbabweans was actually at a play, Miriam Makeba play. And it was so wonderful to see many of us there. And so that community for me bloomed from there. But I will be honest, I move through eclectic communities here. And I think it just has to do with my work as a creative. So just a lot of black community, black American communities, and of color communities, and of course white communities here, because those are sort of the main writing communities in the US. So I think I dip in and dip out in a lot of these. I'm also loner by nature.
Okay.
I'm a hermit. I'm that child who was always seen with a book rather than, you know, talking with others. So that's probably also influenced.
I'm interested because one of the things you and I have in common is I also go to Boston quite often because I've been teaching at Harvard for the past 8 years. I'm actually going there again next week to teach. And I'm wondering your experience teaching in Boston at Emerson College. There's so much diversity in your students. Can they actually relate to your African experience? Is that something that you discuss with them, or is it just kind of like a clinical kind of teaching style that is not so much dependent on your own Zimbabwe/African experience?
That's a great question. I mean, because we're talking here creative, right? We're talking the art. So one brings themselves into the space. I know for some of my students, I'm the first black woman professor that they're the first black professor, the first black woman professor, the first African that they're encountering, particularly the undergrads. So I first day of class, I introduce myself and I give my history, where I'm from, what I do. And throughout in my syllabus, right, I make sure I always assign a diverse works, including works from the continent. Because it's a creative writing class, inevitably the students bring themselves and we have conversations around difference. It's one of the key things happening in academia right now, but also in the United States. So for me, the classroom is a microcosm of what's happening in the society. And I think my students, they more or less fare well with it, perhaps because it's a controlled and curated space. I won't say there haven't been awkward moments, but for me, that's part of the work of difference. Slip of the tongue, or I had an interesting question the other day. A student said to me, this was during break, like, oh, English is your second language, right? I just wondered where that question came from. And I said, well, it's my first language. We're colonized by the British. So I was learning English in school before I learned my own language. And you see the surprise. So I think there's also these projections that me and the students have to work through together throughout the semester in the classroom.
Yeah.
But I think that's just part of the work. That's just part of the work we do as creatives. I'll say one of the most difficult things for me, I'm also a young professor, I'm 36. It also has to do with how to establish authority in the classroom, right? That's something, again, I'm aware of as just a young professor who's not from this country. One maybe is perhaps questioned more than would, say, a white male older professor. But it's good talking to my colleagues. They say they had some experiences when they were younger. And we have a great community in Emerson, faculty, women, a women's group, women faculty, black faculty. So we meet regularly to talk about the struggles we face in the classroom and have strategies for how to deal with it. So I really appreciated that sort of support.
I wanted to ask you if your students are actually able to locate Zimbabwe on the map or even know where Zimbabwe is. And the reason I asked that is because when my first year teaching, I was surprised that most of my American students had no idea where Togo was. And I didn't, you know, judge them as a result of that lack of knowledge, because Togo is a very small country. But Zimbabwe is a country that is mentioned in the news more than Togo, say. So do you think your students know where Zimbabwe is?
You'll be surprised to learn no. They don't know who Mugabe is. They don't know where Zimbabwe is. It's not even in their locus.
Yes.
I wonder if it's also just a generational thing. And I don't know if you experienced that in your classroom. So even the conversations we have around art and creativity, the students have their own language. The Gen Z, the Gen Alpha, their own language as to art and creativity. So I do enjoy those moments in the classroom where I press them, right? So for me, it's this intercultural exchange. Well, give them a little tidbit about where I'm from and they'll let me know, you know, whatever it is they're discussing culturally.
Yeah.
I don't hold it against them either. I'm used to it.
I think it's a beautiful
Zimbabwe
thing.
Like, I've been asked, are you French? I'm like, no, Zimbabwe is in like Southern Africa. What, French? I don't know what that means.
Yeah, we're so used to that. But that's so cute.
Togo, I understand. Where's Togo? Wait, don't judge me. Togo is like Central Africa. Tell me I'm right. Central Africa.
Now I always say Togo in West Africa, just so they can know. And then when I want to be more precise, I say Togo next to Ghana in West Africa. So.
See, I feel bad because I did not know Togo was next to Ghana, Claude.
I'm going to scrap this interview. I'm going to delete everything from this interview. This is really a great way for me to ask you about your current relationship to Zimbabwe. Do you go back? What is your, you know, affinity at this moment?
Ooh, Zimbabwe. I went back last year in 2023. My relationship with Zimbabwe is complicated. And it's probably going to get more complicated. On a political level, you know, it's always nice to be home. It's very emotional, but it's also frustrating. We have become the quintessential post-colonial nation. You know, there's this trope of a downward spiral without a visible end. And that can be a bit depressing, but there's also the sense of life going on. Zimbabweans are bubbly. People are living life. People are enjoying life as best they can. So there are those two dichotomies for me, which is the dream for Zimbabwe, what we're capable of as a people, what we're losing, but also the sense of just history, right? People have dreams, people live and people enjoy their lives. Because I identify as queer, and so I went to Zimbabwe with my partner, who's Jamaican. She's a Jamaican-American writer. My relationship with Zimbabwe, I think, has become a bit more complicated. I don't know if I will go home again anytime soon.
Because of the homophobia?
But I will tell you, interestingly, a lawyer friend pointed out that, you know, in Zimbabwe, there's no actual legal law, right? There's no legal law against LGBTQI people, but there's social persecution. But even in that, she was saying Zimbabwe is so patriarchal that no one ever speaks about queer relationships between women. It's always the law or the fascination is always around sort of male-to-male relationships, which is for me very interesting about how the country conceives of women. But of course, one worries for one's safety and also just social stigma. Having lived in the USA for 10 years, I find myself quite intolerant of the social stigma against queerness. And so that for me, more than the legal, it's the societal shame that becomes difficult to navigate.
I can understand that I want to ask you a couple more questions on your writing. I'm wondering, given that you mentioned earlier, again, Tsitsi Dangarembga, the acclaimed Zimbabwean novelist and playwright, can you tell us perhaps about some other African, perhaps women African writers that you admire that might have influenced you?
Beautiful. Beautiful. Of course, there's No Violet Bulawayo.
Yes.
Brilliant writer, and she's doing the work.
But now we're in Zimbabwe. Let's get, come out of Zimbabwe a little bit. Let's find a way to...
You mean globally?
In African, globally, or in the African diaspora, or...
The African diaspora.
Or even on the African continent outside of Zimbabwe.
It's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
How surprising.
You laugh, Claude. I went to a workshop, you know, in 2009, I went to the Purple Hibiscus workshop, or 2010, run by Chimamanda. That was my first exposure, I think, to sort of intercultural exchange in art. And that was transformative for me. So she, you know, she's really done a lot for many of us young African writers in just terms of those fundamentals. Alexia Arthurs was a Jamaican writer. You know, and I don't only read Audre Lorde, whom I'm currently actually reading, for some nonfiction. Paul Marshall, Toni Morrison, Zugi Sawana, she's a South African writer. Phumla Dinyokola, nonfiction, she's again a South African writer. I'm going to go back to Zimbabwe again. You know, her name escapes me. Butterfly Burning.
Oh, I didn't read that. If it's a novel, I wouldn't have read it.
Yvonne Vera. She's one of our iconic writers. She was writing in the 80s and 90s in Zimbabwe. Yvonne Vera, Butterfly Burning. So those are just some of the women whose shoulders I stand on and continue to rise on.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I want to thank you, Nuvuya Rosa Tsuma, for this fantastic interview. We had a lot of fun. I certainly had a lot of fun. I don't know about you, but it was great to learn about you and your and your creative process and your migration and your dreams and aspirations. This was fantastic. So I look forward to staying in touch.
It's been a pleasure, Claude. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. It should give you some ideas on what to read next. Remember to leave a review if you are listening on Apple Podcasts. If you are listening on Spotify, please subscribe. And if you are listening on any other platform, please share it with your friends. You've been listening to Limitless. I'm Claude Grunitzky. The Limitless Podcast is a production of True Africa. This podcast is made possible with a grant from the United States Department of State and the Scene Fire Foundation.